May 19th, 2020, session of TeamSpeak for Tangerine SDR. My name is Dave, KV0S, and this week I've been working with Dave a little bit on some projects. I also, we had a Tapper board meeting that took a big part of a day. And I was finishing up my grading and that kind of stuff. So I have one less thing to do each week now for a while. So that's kind of nice. So that's about it for me. Next on the list, we have Dave, KD0EAG. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello, everyone. I've just been working on code and documentation. The last few days, nothing very exciting. You probably saw the note. I made my alpha GitHub repo public. It's still buggy, I know, but it was getting to where there might be some people who needed it, so I thought I'd better let him try it and then report back to me. Otherwise, just plugging along, carrying on. That's it. Back over to you, Dave.
Oh, Dave's comment reminded me I did work on the Tangerine website a little bit. And under project components, they're now called modules instead of boards. And I added a page for Dave's project for the magnetometer sensor. So take a look at that. And as other pieces come available, we'll link them up and put them in. And so we'll have that. This is more of the non-participant that wants to learn about the project. So next on the list, we have Elizabeth. Go ahead, Elizabeth.
Hi, everyone. I wanted to mention something about one of our plans and our project. So we decided to build our own HF here at in Houston, but I also wanted to know if it's still possible that we can use your HF as a ground station when we go to Alaska.
I think that's very possible.
Okay, yeah, great. So we're looking at possibilities of, you know, building our own that will allow us to fly it on a balloon, but we still want to use a ground station, HF, and put it in the observatory in Alaska. Poker Flats, it's the name of it, where we are thinking to take it to if we use your HF.
Yeah, I think that sounds possible to me. I'm gonna be talking with Scotty later this week about our current schedule for actually producing things. So, you know, probably next week I'll have a much more firm idea of where we are with that. But I'm thinking that certainly using it as a ground station is a very feasible thing to do. Basically a year from now.
Yes, that's what Dr. Baring thought about, that it will be better to just use it as a ground station instead of fly it on a balloon, since there's a lot of, you know, weight restrictions that we have. And so it will be better to just use it as a ground station instead. It will allow us to also compare our data, you know, with a ground station and a balloon payload.
Yeah, I think that's a really good idea, because this device has really been thought of from the beginning as a ground station. And so I think we are probably better prepared to handle it from that perspective right now. And I know at Poker Flat, I'm imagining you will have the ability to keep things a little bit more climate controlled. Is it going to be an inside thing, or is it still going to run outside?
It's an inside thing. It's just, there is, it's an observatory, so there is a lot of cameras and experiments that are running there on a daily basis. And so it's on the roof, and each instrument has like a window, kind of, it looks like a sphere, but it's actually like a window where, you know, we just place instruments there to collect data day and night for until the USB card, you know, fills up. So, but it's going to be inside.
So like in a radome then?
Yes.
Well, and I think you're talking about like optical type of domes, right?
Yes.
Yeah. They have been in the building before. They have a nice data center up on the second floor. And the domes they have are optical ones where you can go inside and look out through the plexiglass.
Yeah, so that's where we would like to take it and leave it there, you know, for the whole 3 weeks that we're going to be there. And we are going to fly the one that we're going to build, hopefully, on the balloon. So if we don't recover it, you know, we don't recover it, but at least we will still have yours on ground. So that'll be good.
Yeah, I think that makes sense because we could probably, I mean, if we're doing it, especially for like a ground type of mission, you know, we could probably lend it to you for a certain amount of time. And that would probably work out fine.
Okay, great.
But as I said, let me talk with Scotty again later this week and get all those plans worked out, and then we'll get back to you. But I think it's very possible.
I'm going to continue with the list, and then we'll have further discussion later. Next on the list is Mike, AAK, shown is recording in a way, and we thank Mike for posting the TeamSpeak sessions to tangerinesdr.com. TS Archive is the name. There's a link on the website. Next on the list is Nathaniel, W2NAF. Go ahead, Nathaniel.
Thank you very much, Dave. It's a pleasure to be here. Let's see, we are wrapping up things at the University of Scranton here. So our classes ended on Friday, and now the students are in the middle of final exam week. And so some of my students have a project due tonight at midnight. Other students have a take-home exam due at midnight on Wednesday night. So I'm trying to deal with that, and also a bunch of grading and review stuff for other things as well. So things are moving along. W2NAF, back to net.
Thank you. And next on the list is Tom in 5EG. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, good evening, Dave, and everyone in the group. Been a quiet week, not much going on. I did clone and build Dave's magnetometer code, and it built real clean and came right up. So that's about it.
Next on the list is Scotty, WA2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
Okay, thanks, Dave, and thanks for running the show again. We really appreciate it. And this week, spent pretty much most of the week on Data Engine, trying to get that wrapped up. So some gnarly things that have to be done. Still working on the pin assignments and making sure we don't have any conflicts, of which there are plenty to deal with. So looking forward to that. Also, looks like the job that our CAD guy is working on is going to be finished up this week. And he's told me that he has some time next week to work on the magnetometer layout. So I don't see that as a very hard layout. So I'm hoping by next week we'll have the layout done for the magnetometer. So that's it. Back to you, Dave.
Fine business. And next on the list is Bill, AB4EJ. Go ahead, Bill.
Well, thanks, Dave. And thanks for all you do. Been pretty busy. Enjoyed Contest University. Another good presentation by Nathaniel and by several other presenters. Learned a lot about grounding and bonding. And okay, I updated the interface spec between the data engine and the local host, and a little bit more information that I'm hoping would be useful to those guys who are going to code up the FPGA code. I worked in an example of how to do a restart in my simulator and learned a few things doing that, namely that certain types of crashes that could occur, you don't necessarily know what port the thing is listening on, so you have to figure out something on that. I think I know how to approach that, but anyway. Also, I played around with doing some multi-frequency simulation, simulating different frequencies being output by the system, synthesizing I and Q data, and then validating that all that comes through and shows up in digital RF just like it's supposed to. Made some good progress with that today. And it also, I also recognized it would not be that difficult to develop an out-of-tree module for GNU Radio to be able to pick up the data. So I figure the thing to do is to have a function in the local host where I put the data engine into a data mode, an output mode, not necessarily fire hose mode because that's got an awful wide bandwidth, but a mode where it's putting out some reasonable set of bandwidths, and then have an outer pre-module that understands it and can pick up the UDP data and do whatever inside of GNU Radio, such as displaying the output on a spectrum scope or whatever. So going to take a look at that a little bit during this upcoming week. Okay, back to Ned.
Fine business, Bill. And that brings us to the end of the list, so we're open for general discussion. I will say, Dave, I think it was Saturday that, or I don't know, I've been running, I started up your code just after you sent it to me, I guess, and it's been running continuously since then, cranking out JSON packets. So it's cranking right along.
Well, I hope the data means something. I'm glad to hear it's running stable, though. I keep pushing out some little changes, and there are some things, well, mostly features that just aren't implemented that I am continuing to work on. Hope to get that mostly cleaned up pretty soon.
What types of things aren't implemented yet, Dave?
Well, frankly, I think, well, most things are, but it kind of reports back when you ask it for the gain level. It doesn't reflect the changes you've made in the cycle, repetitive measurement averaging, I guess it would be a better name for it. The gain is intertwined with that, and it's not reporting that back correctly. Some of the things probably have to do with, since I'm not really using it for anything, some of them won't rear their ugly heads until someone actually wants it to do something, and then finds that one option, overwrites another or something like that, and they'll have to tell me about it. But other than that, it's not, it's still just test code, because obviously, I guess the whole strategy is to use the FPGA to do all this stuff in the end. And if the FPGA does it, the code is utterly different. But at least this gives people something to explore and evaluate with.
I think that sounds really good. So then we just need to get this, up to some of these testing facilities and have it, tested in the lab, either with Human or with David McGaw, and then hopefully compared to some other, actual ground magnetometer observations.
Yeah, at this point, both Human and David McGaw, I don't know if David's had time to put together the boards I sent him, Hume and I sent, working ones, and John Gibbons, I guess, Julius also has a full set, and I do. So, but it requires someone who knows what they want to see.
Yeah, and certainly both Hume and David McGaw would know what they want to see.
Well, you got to have something to look at to know if it'll do it. So I guess this is hopefully will be that.
All right. Well, thank you so much. That sounds like really good progress.
The magnetometer, I'm running just the single test board, what Dave calls the simple board, and the numbers seem much more reasonable than the ones from the previous version.
Yeah, actually, Julius sort of stumbled on what I was doing wrong that had worried me ever since last winter. About getting, you know, the X value was just way larger than the Y and Z. And he kind of narrowed it down somewhat. And I could see how setting different things overwrote each other. And getting the sequence right and doing it in a simpler way seemed to clear that up. I guess, you know, at least it looks a lot better, at least less strange to my eye.
The one thing I really like the hyphen capital P command, because that gives you a report of how things are set. One thing that would be convenient but not necessary is there are some parameters that report back in hexadecimal, and you need to enter the integer value, and I would think that would be terribly confusing for some users.
Yeah, I noticed that in your grappling with getting the code to behave with your module, and so you sent me a report of all the things you tried, and I saw that was tripping you up. So that's another thing that needs to be resolved in some way, either, you know, make it clear that it's a hex digit pair, do some checking on the values that are entered, something. Haven't entirely sort of decided what's the best way yet.
For everybody else, the magnetometer that I have, instead of being on one of the components, I think it's either magnetometer or the temperature. It was the temperature sensor. Instead of being on 19, it's on 1C, which is integer 28 for those who don't think in those numbers quickly.
Yeah, so you have to use a command line option to set the value. Actually, a lot of cases will need to use a command line option for one thing or another. But my help output is not as clear as it could be about what you're supposed to do.
By the way, if you go to the website and look at the magnetometer stuff, there's links there, a general description. There are links to the design documents that we've had in the document file. I find that a lot of people overlook looking in that document directory. And so I have the specific magnetometer documents linked. And then there is a link to Dave's GitHub where all this is found. And he has a really nice set of really detailed helps, like how to set certain things. And those would be easily overlooked. And then it has a picture of at least one board, and it has the block diagram from the design document on the page. So it's kind of the model that I'd like to make for all the boards, and actually something like it for software as well, so that it gives you links to all the resource information you need to know for that particular topic.
There's actually will be a wiki, you know, a GitHub wiki associated with that repo that has some of my instructions in it that we can just put a link, I imagine, direct to it.
Yeah, Dave W., what are the current addresses for the boards that are out there for the magnetometer and for the temp sensor? Did you, because Dave mentioned his was like 1C for the temperature sensor. Is that because what I did is I rigged it so that you can basically get addresses for both the magnetometer and temperature sensor, both on the remote end and the local end, and they're different. Now, I think on yours, the magnetometer stays at the same address, independent of whether it's on the end of a cable or not. Is that right?
Sorry, hit the wrong button. The magnetometer on mine stays at the same address. It's just either populated or not, depending on whether it's a local or a remote board. So it's always at 20. I was going to put in some way to switch to the optional address, but I never got to it and didn't see any point in going further. Now on the temperature sensors, I do have I did in mine. I made them adjustable so they could put up there, because there'll be two active at the same time. I marked them. It's no real default, I don't suppose, but the default address for that is 18 hex. But I put that default one at the remote end usually, and I used the 19 hex at the local end for the temperature sensor. It was kind of arbitrary, though. I don't know that it's. And I've left some hooks in this code I'm writing to use whatever standard setups you choose, so that someone can just say they have a Scotty board and it'll default to the right things, I hope.
Okay, good, because I'm using 18 for the temperature sensor for local and 19 for remote. And 22 for the local magnetometer and 23 for the remote. And the way I have it rigged up that way is that since there's multiple ground pins on the Raspberry Pi header, I just rigged the address line up to the ground pin so that if you have a Raspberry Pi plugged in, then you get the address LSB 0. So they all so basically when you unplug it from the Raspberry Pi and put it on the remote end, both addresses bump up by one. So automatically, so there's no strap, no jumper. But if you've got a table or something that we can use, and that would be awesome. You just program in this board and it'll work.
Okay, that's different. But you're using, I didn't even know the magnetometer could be set to those addresses. And you're planning for two magnetometer modules, one local and one remote?
Well, the theory is if you really want to plug one in local and one in remote, it will still work. Normally, you wouldn't do that, but I didn't see any reason why, if you left it plugged in on both ends, that we couldn't have different addresses. Because, yeah, the magnetometer actually has three of the LSB address pins that you can set to whatever you like, as does the temperature sensor. So what I did is I just connected A0 of both of them together and hooked them so that they're pulled up, and when you plug it into the Raspberry Pi, it pulls it down. So you get a zero on the LSB if it's plugged into the Pi, and if you unplug it and run it remotely, then the LSB becomes a one. So it just moves all the addresses up by one, well, all of them, both addresses. So it saves me a jumper on the board.
Wow. Well, I guess customers do change the spec on you. Certainly not what I was working from. But I guess there's probably no reason why it can't be made to work that way.
Okay, well, but the thing is, if you use 20 for yours, and you basically have the same address for both, so you only plug it in on one, my philosophy was kind of like, well, let's make it not interfere with yours, make it different, so that the software can look out and say, oh, that's Dave's board, or oh, that's Scotty's board.
I see. Whatever. Yeah. Well, mine can be used locally with a magnetometer unit on it, but I don't know. 20 was the natural default for the for the board as far as the documentation went. So I that's where I began, and I really just didn't stray from that too much. And I did. I thought there was only one. I thought there were only four, a smaller number of addresses possible, but you're probably right, and I have to look at that. All I need to do is make sure, I may try to sanity test some of the values as they are set, so that, you know, at least so that they stay in conceivable ranges.
Yeah, I did misspeak. It's only 2 bits on the magnetometer. You get the 2 LS bits, SA0 and SA1. So, and they are, I believe they're pulled down. So if you don't connect them to anything, you get 0, which is the default. But I think on your schematic, you pulled it, you pulled them all down. So that gives you 0.
Yeah, I think I had to. Something, at least, it, you know, I think I copied what they did on their development board, actually. I studied the traces on that, which is not really well documented sometimes.
Yeah, well, as soon as we get a beta version of this, I'll send you one, and then you can play with it and see if it's going to work like this or we have to change something.
Be real nice to see, you know, to make sure that there's some software that can you know, let people test it just with nothing but the, you know, by just plug it into their single board device, because that, you know, it'd be good for diagnostic and stuff like that.
Well, that's kind of why I was thinking of, well, if you're going to make it different at all, make it completely different so that it can be identified and then adapted to, rather than make it overlap and make it difficult to identify.
Yeah, there's no way to unambiguously identify what's plugged into, you know, what's plugged into the bus, but hopefully there won't be too many strange things out there.
Say, do either of these devices, the temperature or the magnetometer, have a vid or PID?
No.
Yeah, that, Dave, I think those are only for USB devices.
Oh, okay.
They might have some kind of ID byte that would identify it at a particular location. Let me take a quick look. I don't remember seeing that in the magnetometer, but the temperature sensor might have something like that.
The magnetometer, you know, has a version that you can check, but it's just returns a number. There might be something else. They didn't emphasize it very much in the documentation. And I haven't gotten very fancy with things to do with the temperature sensor. That temperature sensor has a lot of, I don't know if they're of any use to us, but it does have an alarm pin where it can set, it can trigger, I'm sure we don't want to fool with it now, but it always struck me that it could, you know, in these low temperature settings or something, it could be used to turn on a heater, as has been sometimes discussed, if the temperature dropped too low, or something like that, maybe in a future version.
Yeah, the 9808 has a manufacturer ID register and a device ID register. So it's not strictly a vid/PID, but it manufacturer ID is 0054 hex. It's a 16-bit value.
Yeah, we can check that if there's some reason to. I just hadn't been very concerned. I knew what I was soldering onto the boards.
Well, yeah. I was just thinking, now that we're going to have 2 boards, just if there were ways that easily identify them, and I guess Scotty fixed that when he just used different address spaces, but that was my idea.
It's got a device ID and a revision ID also in another 16-bit register, which is two 8-bit fields. And it looks like the magnetometer has a Rev ID register, but I don't see a manufacturer ID here yet.
I do check the Rev ID. I do a validation on that, partly because it was the first thing I figured out how to check, but one thing I could get a solid result back from without too much bit twiddling.
So, Dave, you have these configuration files for the single board computer. Could you use the parameter file there to set the different as the hex numbers of the devices move around? Could you set them in there?
I'm not sure what you're talking about. Are you talking about the stuff where I show how to set the data rate in the DTB in the device tree database?
It's the stuff that you put on the A hyphen A comment hyphen sorry hyphen A switch.
Oh yeah, well, and what would you? All that really does is lists the values that you should use with the hyphen B option for various different single board computers that I happen to know about. It really is just an informational thing. I started to try to make something fancier where you could tell it the board type, but it just got unwieldy and not, it looked like it was more trouble than the value it provided.
So what I did is I would pick a hyphen B and then get the I-squared C dev number, and then I would do a I-squared C detect on that, and that gave me all the active hex numbers.
Yeah, that's kind of what I intended. It'll basically say if you've got a Raspberry Pi, then use bus 1. If you've got a Odroid N, use bus 2. And these are the buses, not the device. And you can use the IC tools to list the devices that are out there. But for most use cases, except for things like the Odroid Xavier, which it's on I2C bus 8, there's not so much variation at this stage of the game. But I did want to make it flexible enough that people could use whatever was needed. I didn't want to make an all-around I2C testing tool, particularly. I wish I could, but not in this lifetime, I suspect.
Well, I did notice, I've tested it, not this current software, but the previous software on Raspberry Pi, Odroid N2, and Jetson Nano. And I remember one of those was very different. It was on a 1, where the other ones are on 2, I think. Or maybe it's 2 are on 1 and 1 is on 2.
Yeah, that dash A was just, those are all in there. That was just to give something to jog people's memory of the commonest boards I thought we'd encounter. It's really because I had worked on something more elaborate and hated to delete all the code and undo the option. So I left it there and just made it informational.
Well, I really like the dash capital P informational comment.
Yeah, I wanted you to be able to tell what it is it was, and I wanted to know myself what it thought I had told it to do. presumably all of this will be distilled down into the, the nectar of the gods that in Verilog that goes into the DE, and no one will need to care anymore. But for now, it was nice to have.
Well, I can still see these boards as being used with the Raspberry Pi standalone.
Yeah, well, and for that, they'll collect a good bit of data, and I think maybe some of the other people, like John Gibbons, were interested in seeing how you did each of these things and then extracting the code and putting it into their device that they were going to use without a FPGA in there. Anyway, I really appreciate anybody's opinions that can tell me how to make it more useful.
I think it's useful enough that it's out there and people are getting to use it.
Yeah, in the end, it's not that insanely magical of code, but it took me a while to sort it out for some reason. So there it is. And it's an example for others.
Well, I hope it's not too hard to adjust the addresses.
Not at all. It's. Oh, you mean to put new ones in? Right now you can put in any address you want. There's a dash lowercase l option for the local temperature sensor. There's a dash lowercase r option for the remote one. There's a and I think there's one for the address of the magnetometer itself, though I've never tested that because I didn't make any boards that I could change that. I guess I have one that's kind of wire wrapped that I could do that with. But it should be trivial. I put everything into a big struct that I just put to every function, and so all the information's in there. And I have mostly tried to use everything out of that struct to control the behavior. So if you take and the initialization save that. I don't know if anybody wants me to be able to save a configuration to a file and then reload it again. Sooner or later, I'll probably put that in. But if somebody wants it, say so.
Well, right now, it'd be nice just to have the ones built for the hardware that we have. So if there's variants, it sounds like maybe your early boards were wired up differently.
Well, no. It's trivial to move either the defaults or the command line. Addresses are easy in this now. That's not a problem.
Yeah. So the only hard part will be is if the software finds two temperature sensors, it's got to know which one is which one's local and which one's remote, right?
Well, frankly, I do keep track of which one's local and which one's remote so that I can format the output, with the right one pointing at the right thing. You could override it and put them backwards, and it would be none the wiser. I was going to make a set of defaults especially for your boards, so you could take the standard settings in one go. But the one thing I'm not sure I'll just confuse you if I talk about it, but kind of separate from anything we're discussing here, one thing I don't know if there's a simple way to force the I2C driver into the 100 kilohertz per second mode without someone having to go in and edit the device tree, which will be a little bit different on every every single board computer, because and that's, you know, that's kind of hairy for most people to go in and edit the device tree. The device tree is a structure that they made a few years ago for these embedded Linuxes that describes where everything really is in the hardware, as opposed to where it seems to be to an end user, meaning someone right at our level. But you can actually remap most everything in these processors to something else if you put your mind to it. And it's all governed by a database that gets read at boot up. But the speed of the I2C interface can be configured in there. And the default is almost always these days higher than the 100K, which we specified and I was trying to stick to. And I don't know a way to do it. I haven't looked for a way to do it from the app itself. I don't know if it's possible to override the hard configuration at runtime. But it's something else I want to look into.
Say, Scotty, we should mention that coming up in the next month or so, we're going to probably have a call for papers for DCC. And so anybody who's thinking about a paper, that's a possibility.
Yes, definitely. And the two that come right to mind for me are Dave's magnetometer work and Bill's software work.
You think they're going to be, overall, folks are going to be welcoming to that? I've had comments when I did something that was a little bit out of the ham zone. And the magnetometer really isn't a radio. It's something else. I'd be interested, but I don't know if everybody else would.
Well, it's a peripheral for the personal space weather station, so it's kind of like a ham-sci hardware. So that would be, I think, akin to talking about an SDR radio at the ham-sci conference, which we do all the time, since this will be applicable to hams who want to do scientific stuff.
I think it's very appropriate, but... I think people who have a narrow view probably, I consider Tapper and Tangerine SDR and HamSci as people who are pushing the envelope of what normal ham radio is.
Yeah, and I think what would be cool is to start out with the experimentation that you did and the mods you made and the variants that you made and then how it morphed into a hat module that became part of the personal space weather station. So kind of show the people, well, this is how you get started in things, and this is how they morph into something that becomes more of an application-specific thing from a research thing.
And one other thing you can do is, if you're concerned about that, you can put together a slide or two that, again, shows how measurements from a ground magnetometer are related to, you know, HF radio propagation to help justify why we're doing this in a ham radio conference. And I'll be glad to help you put together a slide or two like that.
That might be useful because, I don't know how serious anybody was, but I had some sense that in a previous thing, people questioned stuff, even though it was an SDR of sorts. But anyway, we'll see.
Well, it did occur to me that some people might be interested because FT8 mode is so interesting now. It's got so much popularity that you could do some analytics in real time using the Tangerine and really show some graphics that indicate what's been going on in the band and what the trends are. I mean, I think a lot of people would like to see what's going on trend-wise in the bands in their station. So they say, oh, looks, 20 meters is heading up. Maybe that's where I'll go hang out rather than on a band that seems to be declining, that kind of thing.
I was also going to mention to Nathaniel, what would be really interesting is to some sort of diagram or two of the map of the declinations in the magnetic field of the Earth, and what would happen if you actually added higher resolution dot densities for samplers, and how that would change our perceptions of what those patterns are. We think of them as being very broad and not very specific, but I think there's a lot more detail that we'll find when we start putting sensors everywhere.
Yeah, I think one thing to remember too is, like, when you see those declination maps, I believe those are set more by things within the Earth, but a lot of the variability that we see in the Earth's magnetic field is what comes from space. That's where you see all of these perturbations. It's from the space. And I think that's one of the things to show. The other thing to show is that along with those declinations, that, you know, there have been some papers that show how total electron content, you know, can behave differently with regard to where, you know, where the magnetic field lines are. There's some really nice ways that we can show how the ionosphere is related to the Earth's magnetic field. And that might be something to show.
Yeah, I think that's a key component of why we're interested in magnetometers in a radio context, because it does have an effect.
Yeah, well, if you think about it, you know, when you go to like QRZ.com and you see little space weather forecasts or I should say like nowcasts, or you get these warnings about what's happening with the radio bands, a lot of the times they talk about the KP index, and the KP index is high and there's a geomagnetic storm. Well, where do you get the KP index measurement from? That KP index measurement all comes from ground magnetometers. So we're already using ground magnetometers to inform us how our radios are going to behave.
Yep. And those points just need to be made.
Yeah. And if I think you do that, then I think the whole ground magnetometer fits very well into the Tapper radio paradigm.
Well, I just want to make sure people are interested. That's all.
Now, remember, it is online this time.
Yes. Quite a lot.
Since it's online, does that make it harder for people to throw bananas at us if they don't like our presentation?
Yeah, no tomatoes.
Or tangerines.
Ooh.
Oh, no.
Hey, but you know, I remember going to the ECC and hearing Phil Karn's talk on broadcast IP. Now, you know, that does nothing to do with radio, but it's interesting for people who are hooking radios up to the internet.
It was a great talk, and it took me a while. It was not in an obvious place where I could retrieve it, but I finally found it and added it to some lists on the video side.
There's an awful lot that goes into the things we do, and, you know, I tend to take a real broad view. I just want to be sure that, you know, I'm not boring people who don't see things quite the same way.
Well, I like to see a variety, because there's always things I'm not that interested in, and then there's things that I'm really interested in. So as long as there's a broad spectrum, then there's enough room for all of us to have our own pet projects. So I just think that it'd be interesting for the hams to take a look at kind of a microscope look at a project and how it got started, how it evolved, how it turned into a Tapper off-the-shelf product, and why we did it, and, you know, the trials and tribulations that you went through to actually get the thing to work, and a whole bunch of details that people normally don't get to see that they might be interested in.
And, you know, think about the value of having an online forum for this. I mean, if somebody goes into a lot of detail on something that a particular viewer is not interested on, they can do something else for a few minutes without disturbing anybody else, without having to get up and walk out of a presentation. They can just, mute the thing and go and work a few contacts on FT8 and then come back a minute later.
They can work FT8 while they're listening to the conference.
Absolutely, you could.
That sounds very interesting. I'm looking forward to it.
I'm going to do a presentation on cross stitch by radio.
I did want to mention that I want all of you to be thinking about this, but we ought to produce a number of kind of how-to videos that are explaining the setup or use of different parts of the Tangerine system.
Yeah, it would be nice to preserve all that for posterity for sure, because you're still getting a lot of HPSDR questions about how to set up. I just opened this box and I got this out and I can't remember how it worked.
There's a lot of Atlas questions right now, and that was what, 12 years ago?
Yeah, and we sold like 500 of those, so eventually they're going to start showing up in flea markets and people are going to go, what can I do with this?
The documents are all still on the website.
So I just saw that recent thread. Is he doing okay, the guy putting his Atlas back on the air?
I believe so, yeah. A couple people helped him. People write questions, and since my name's on the website, I get questions for stuff that I've never done because I've never been in that situation, particularly when they ask me Windows questions, because I have one Windows computer and it belongs to the university and I don't put radio stuff on it.
Yeah, and believe it or not, we're packing up our building here to do our relocation. I'm just now packing up the bench that I use to build all of the HPSDR boards and test all of them. So how many years is that now?
Well, I remember you and Dan cranking through those things, and you had a pretty extensive set of test fixtures.
Yep, and they're being packed up now and gone through and pitching out the stuff we don't need and keeping the stuff we do. But it's just amazing that bench is set there unused for so many years.
That is amazing. But my two Atlas radios work great, and I'm using them, and as well as Hermes, so I keep exercising all of them at one point and another.
Yeah, that guy that had the bad, Metis board was bad, or Aussie board, I've been afraid to suggest that we could fix it for him.
At this point, it'd be easier to find an old one and replace it.
Yeah, I think so, and especially since maybe 6 months ago it would have worked, but now pretty much all that stuff is in my lab is torn down, so I'd have to recreate it again, and I don't really think it's worth it. I think it's my lab's going to be Tangerine now coming up here pretty quick. And speaking of that, I have a question for Tom before we run over our time, which is about, what, 3 more minutes?
Yes, I have a question for Tom, too.
Okay, you can go first.
Did you say I should go first?
Yes, go ahead.
Tom, this is a blast from the past. I was talking to Steve Bible and asked about the license on your book, and he said that it does belong to Tapper and you were open to anything, Tapper using the book. And he told me that Greg Jones had created a Rev2, but it never went anywhere, and he claimed he had one, and John Koster claimed he had one, and I asked about resurrecting that and at least probably putting it on Lulu or as a PDF and or on demand printed. Do you have any of those documents?
I'll have to look. We produced a second printing, which had a lot of, there were a couple of mistakes in the first printing that were fixed. I don't know, I saw actual physical copies of the book, but I don't have any electronic files.
Well, I believe Steve or John claimed to have it on a CD somewhere. Scotty, did you get one of those CDs?
Was that one they gave out at a DCC?
It was something that Greg Jones created, and he handed out, and it had it on it.
I only would have got it if it was handed out with the material at a DCC, because I had never ordered anything like that. I do have a copy of the book, though. I could go check and see if it's first or second edition. My guess is it's first.
Well, Tom, I want to resurrect it since it is a Tapper product. And there's a couple of things in that book that don't seem to be duplicated in the other DSP books still available. So I think there's a real value to having it available. By the way, looking for it online, I found one that was a used copy, and they wanted $80 or $90 for it.
Yeah, the copies go for a lot. It Tapper has all the rights to it, so you know Tapper is free to do whatever with it that they'd like to do.
Well, I just wanted to keep you in the loop and informed of what I would had proposed and am hatching.
Okay, well, you know, if it can live another life, that's probably a good thing.
Okay, very good. Now, this question is much harder, Tom. I've been cogitating over the use of the RF module for a lightning receiver, and I just wonder if you had to modify it to have the lower floor down around 10 kilohertz, what could you do to modify it that would be what would be possible? Because it seems like those transformers are going to shunt all the signal away at those low frequencies, so you're going to really have to disconnect them and couple it another way if you want to copy down on those low frequencies. Is that a correct assessment?
Yeah, there's also coupling capacitors in there as well, because the stage is self-bias at DC and they have some low frequency bias stabilization. So the easy answer is to just redesign it.
Now, I'm thinking in terms of how can we make it work as a as for both frequency ranges. I know this was beyond the scope of what the original design was, but how hard would it be to do that? Would it be like just forget it, or would it be like possible to make a few tweaks?
It's not the latter. I haven't looked at the chips to see where the corner frequencies are on all of the common mode voltage setters and all of the clock bias setters and all of that kind of stuff. So, in fact, I don't think that's even in the data book. The transformers really provide the noise figure setting, the gain adjustments. My view is it's probably fairly challenging to take it down to very low frequency.
So what would be the best way to do it then would be to design a VLF model and then just put a really beefy low-pass filter on it to get rid of the HF and higher stuff. And I'm thinking what I would probably do is I'd clock it something like at least 3 to 5 megahertz so that the broadcast band is not an alias, so that we wouldn't necessarily have to filter it out.
Yeah, remember, you can get very high bit count, low-frequency successive approximation ADC converters fairly inexpensively.
Can you get them above about 3 megahertz?
That's a loaded question, because there are some that use high frequency conversion on the sample clock to do noise, Nyquist noise shifting of the ADC. And I think Bill Tracy and Phil Harmon wrote something about that many years ago. So some of the parts have high clock frequencies, but they're essentially 1-bit ADDs, and then they use the super high frequency to approximate and regenerate a much higher resolution low frequency sampler. So the clock rate itself isn't necessarily indicative. If you want, like a 24-bit converter, it starts to get expensive when you get up to high clock rates.
Well, I remember when they tested 4 or 5 ADCs that went to 192K, and they were all supposedly created equal, but in the end, they weren't created equal, because when you got up above about 20 kilohertz, some of them started to roll off and some of them didn't, or some of them rolled off worse than others. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, there are two different aspects. One is that the converter itself has a frequency response you can get very, you know, high precision converters that are low frequency in nature fairly inexpensively. What Bill, I think, found was that the Nyquist noise of the converters was optimized for low noise in the low frequency up to about 20 kilohertz audio passband, and that the sampling noise increased dramatically above audio because the manufacturer didn't expect the user to try to use the device below above about 20 kilohertz. And so they found some had low noise up to, you know, half of the sample rate, up to, you know, like 96K, where other devices did not. They assumed you were going to use it below 20K no matter what.
Yeah. I'm just thinking that I'd like to get the Nyquist rate above the American broadcast band, the medium wave band, because people are going to live near those stations, and if you have a very low Nyquist frequency, you're going to have to filter those out, or they're going to image back into your baseband. And it's would be easier just to clock at a higher frequency and have them be something that we could filter out digitally.
Yeah, I would say it's easier to just put a big beefy low pass filter in front of it.
I've been looking at the same things, and I'm no expert in that area at all, but I've looked at designs. Are you talking about using ATEDs intended for audio? I know that's what maybe Phil and Bill were looking at one time, but there are an awful lot of different ones, and there are some that either have one, you know, there are a lot of one megahertz ones. Now I don't know how to read most of the specs, but you know, one megahertz, 12 and 14 bit. I don't know how many bits you want and what ENOB effective number of bits, all those parameters that are desired in something like this.
Well, go ahead, Tom.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to say, yeah, Dave, there are higher precision converters than that available down at lower frequencies. And I have pulled out a data book recently to, you know, to see a catalog to see what's available there. You know, my gut feel says, you know, just put a big low pass filter to make sure that, you know, everything above 300 kilohertz or something is just totally gone.
It's just that if you live a mile from a 50,000 watt station, you know, you're going to have hell to pay to get rid of that down to the noise. But if you sample high enough, as long as you keep it below the saturation point, then you can just digitally filter it out.
Yeah, but you won't keep it below the saturation point.
Well, okay, so you might have to put some attenuation on there, or you might have to put a trap or something. But I still say that that's, I mean, if... Even if you were to get, say, 100 millivolts at 1.6 megahertz, I mean, that was probably absorbable by the ADC if you don't have too much gain in front of it. But it's not something that's going to be easy to filter out. You're going to maybe end up with a shield.
Yeah, the problem is that you get 2 or 3 AM stations, and their peak amplitudes will all add every once in a while, not often, but you'll get them all in phase every once in a while, and the peak will, you know, be up at a volt.
Can we ask Nathaniel if how important the really low bands are for the sampling?
The really low bands, you mean like VLF in that area?
Yeah, so there's a lot of what they're talking about is a simple receiver, but a lot of work to get it to work right. Or I heard somebody talking that a lot of lightning detection was done more around up quite a bit higher up the band.
Well, there's a few things going on. So the first, sorry, I zoned out for a little bit of the last conversation, but the first thing I heard you talking about was whether or not you should put an anti-alias filter on, or you should simply make sure you're sampling above the Nyquist frequency, above the FM broadcast band. and then filter things out digitally. Now that's different than the discussion. That's very different than the discussion about talking about the low bands now, right?
Well, the question is building a low band receiver, and how important is that for lightning detection, or as compared to, well, essentially, do we want to do something like this, or is it sort of an interesting side project?
So the answer to do we want a low band receiver? Absolutely. There is significant scientific reason and great interest in studying the VLF, LF, those low bands. There's a very compelling scientific case for it. Now, the question then I think becomes, does it make sense to do it with the current RF module? Well, that's a different question. I think if it's feasible to not compromise on the capabilities of the HF module while also including the VLF and LF frequencies, then yes, I would say we should be including it. If it comes down to the fact that it's basically one or the other, there are engineering reasons where, you know, we can optimize for HF for medium frequency to high frequency in one module, and then we need to optimize for VLF and LF in the low bands in the second module, that may be the way to go. And my understanding is that's probably the way we want to go, unless you know, we really can do everything in one module without compromise.
I would think you would want a separate. You want a separate module, not the least of which reason is you're going to have quite a bit different antenna for those bands as for HF, right?
I completely agree about the antennas. You'd definitely be using a different type of antenna for the VLF that versus the HF. The reason why I'd still say, okay, let's just build a single module that you can do both with. Well, in that case, then it really cuts down on, you know, production, because people who want LF and people who want HF, you know, they still buy the same piece of like radio hardware, then they just took up different antennas to it, and there's less complexity there. But again, if that only makes sense if you're really not compromising in designing each of those receivers at the board level and not, you know, creating such an increase in cost.
Yeah, so we need to remember that there are specifications attached to receivers. And as I mentioned on that previous call, you know, we need to first build this HF receiver, and then we need to characterize its LF performance.
Yeah, I think that's the right approach right now. And if the LF performance is adequate, great. Because we need to meet those HF specifications. And if not, then I think after this, we should try and design an LF module too.
Well, yeah, and if the performance requirements at LF aren't very severe, you know, maybe the HF is adequate. You know, it won't be a tremendously sensitive receiver, but, you know, maybe it's good enough.
Well, that's
yeah, that's the question is what's needed? What is needed at those low frequencies?
Well, right, also, So suppose we were to take the pluggable module and we were to build a 20 dB preamp that had a bandpass on it of 10 kilohertz to 300 kilohertz. We could make a somewhat mediocre LF receiver that might work okay enough using the existing receiver, because you'd be compensating for the roll-off in the other sections. But it wouldn't be optimum, but it would be usable. Is that feasible, Tom?
Anything's feasible. You know, my view is, you know, let's build it and characterize it first, and then we can come up with plans if needed to see what we can do.
Well, I agree. I'm just, you know, two steps ahead of the game here always.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the real question. Like, Bill Lyles really brought this up, and you know, I know that there are other people that we've talked to recently who are very much, you know, there really is a strong VLF LF community out there, and we should have some ability to meet those needs. So we've come very far with the HF module. We have our specifications laid out. I don't think it makes sense to deviate from what we're doing at the moment, unless you say it's easy to, you know, to basically say, okay, we can also meet VLF specifications with this as well. Otherwise, I say, you know, just like you say, go ahead, build this, characterize it, and then we decide where we can go with it with VLF from there.
Yeah, I'm not suggesting that we change the design of the existing module. I just wanted to get an idea of if we wanted to make one that did VLF also or a VLF only, how much different is it going to be? To make another module, how hard is it going to be?
Okay, tell me the specification, and I can answer the question. Without a specification, you can't answer the question.
Okay, 10 kilohertz to 10 megahertz.
Okay, what's the noise figure? What's the sensitivity? What's the overload? You know, and all the other numbers.
Yeah, now you're getting technical on me.
Yeah, well, you know, when you design a receiver, you got to have specs.
Well, we can, you know, this is something where we should bring Bill Lyles back in or someone who works with VLF more, and they should be able to help us design the specification.
I do think it's going to have to be probably 10 to 500K to satisfy. There's a whole lot of different groups that are interested at different phenomena down there.
Yeah, so we need to come up with a set of specs for that receiver when we get to the point we want to do one.
Obviously, yeah.
Hey, it only took us 2 years to come up with these specs. How hard could it be?
Making it's the easy part.
I think you did it a little faster than the first OpenHPSDR.
Oh, yeah, that's true. We must have learned something then, huh?
Well, at least we hope we did.
And the other thing is now you have... like you have this system for, you know, two different RF modules, and we've already designed it from the beginning to be modular, so it could, you know, incorporate different types of RF modules. So we kind of do have a framework in place for developing a new module, right?
Yeah, and then you build a 10 kilohertz to 500 kilohertz module, and it complements the 500 kilohertz to 50 megahertz module that we have now.
Yeah, now if we design it, can we build in some overlap? You know, so instead of going just from 10 to 500 kilohertz, it goes maybe from like 10 to a megahertz. So there's some region of overlap between the modules that you could compare things against.
Yeah.
Alberto De Beni, I2PhD guy in Italy, designed one just using the STM32F. You know, one of the M53 processors that has A to D's, and he used two of the three, I'm sure these are lousy A to D's, but the A to D's that are built into that chip, and interleaved them with a big, and there's a fairly simple, but an example of a design of a low frequency, you know, of a low pass filter in front of it, and he was using it, you know, for atmospheric phenomena, I guess. It's actually an NXP, or no, is it ST? I don't know. It looked like it was a selection for a prize that they had, a contest of some sort. But I think he had it. He was trying to get it up to at least cover all the way to hit 80 meters at the top end, but I don't think he got there.
Yeah, I think when you guys are ready, we should bring in people like Bill Lyles and Jonathan Rizzo and maybe some other like VLF people, and we can have them, you know, discuss. Come up with the specifications you need, and then we could talk about the feasibility of it.
Is that the link, Dave, that you were talking about?
That's the Hackaday link. There were some others, that were from his own website. There's a PDF that describes it in pretty good detail. But yeah, that's, and they're probably linked there somewhere. That's the thing I'm talking about.
Yeah, my business partner did a WWVB receiver at 60 kilohertz out of a he made it out of a Cypress PSoC. That was a programmable system on a chip. I don't know if you guys remember that part, but and it had an onboard low performance ADC like a 1 megahertz, 12 bitter, I think, either 10 bits or 12 bits. And he made a WWVB receiver out of an 8-pin DIP. processor?
There's actually one by Paul Henning Kemp, you know, who's one of the BSD core developers, but he made a complete a lower end receiver around just out of a, he used one of Dave, you know, John Ackerman's clock blocks and this Olimex developer board that has a has an analog devices processor on it with a one meg 80D, and he was able to make a complete LoRaN receiver out of it.
Well, I want to mention we're going long, but I had one last thing to let everybody know. If any of you were at DCC, I think most of you were at DCC in Detroit, Phil Karn was showing off his WWV simulator. I actually found the code online, so it runs really well on a Mac. It runs okay on Linux, and it doesn't run on Windows.
So what do you mean by okay? Does it hiccup once in a while?
Well, the problem is, building it the way Phil does, he's taken Linux components and strung them together, and the speech synthesizer on the Mac is much better than the speech synthesizer on Linux, and he didn't even try Windows.
Okay. It is, I've heard it on his Mac, though. It is totally awesome.
I have compiled it both on a Mac Mini that I have here and on Linux, and it works great on both boards or both computers, but the speech synthesizer on Linux is kind of sounds very computerish.
I wanted to also to bring up one last thing. Does anybody here have a desire to try a Zoom meeting at some point with audio and video, as opposed to just a TeamSpeak meeting?
I'm certainly good with that.
I think it's a good idea. The problem that we're having, Nathaniel, is George Burkett is the one who has the Tapper Zoom license, so he has to show up for this. I have a Zoom from my university, but I can't use it for here. So we need somebody that can host a meeting to start it.
Well, they were talking about a second license, and if they allow me to be the administrator of it, I can see that this could certainly be run by, this meeting could be run by the Tapper license.
Well, another thing is, I have a license with the University of Alabama, and since we are a grantee on the NSF proposal, I think we could make a, well, I wouldn't hesitate to just go ahead and start it and explain it later if I had to, but I don't think anybody would ever even ask.
Well, I think either you...
I certainly have no problem doing it either.
Yeah, you, Bill, or Nathaniel, both are, this is associated with a funded project. For me, it's not... And my discipline's a slightly different, so it's a bigger stretch.
Oh, right, of course, yes.
Yeah, it's easy for me to do this and to set it up. And I'm not so I'm only allowed to host one meeting at a time. But this every Monday night, guess what meeting I'm on? So this is the one. So I'm perfectly happy to set it up as a standing meeting, and I can set it up so that even if I'm not here. It can be set up so that people can join, can join without me being there. And I can also, provide a host key to select people so that, if they got on and I weren't able to make it for some reason, they would be able to take over host capabilities.
Well,
go ahead, Dave.
As you know, from John Ackerman, we're trying to develop some expertise and experience before we try to run a big conference.
Now, Scotty, does if George has a if Tapper does have a Zoom license and George has it, what you can do is you can set it up to allow people to join before the meeting starts, and then you can do that, and then George can give you the host key and you can sign in, and then you can claim the host role.
Okay, well, we were talking about we really think we need to have at least two hosts anyway, so if we bought the second host license, then I think it would be moot, because if it turns out to be me, if it doesn't turn out to be me, then, like, if it's John Ackerman, then he'd have to do the same kind of thing that you just described.
Yeah, and that works pretty well. I think the biggest danger with, the biggest danger with having it set where you can allow join before host is that, you know, if no one's minding the shop, pretty much anyone, and they have the key or they have the link, anyone can join at any time, and, you know, shenanigans can run afoot. But I haven't really, you know, I haven't really had that trouble with my account. And as long as you're not, like, recording anything, I don't really see a big problem with it.
Yeah, and I wasn't really suggesting that we go switch over to Zoom and use that exclusively. I just was interested in what people thought about maybe trying it out once.
I will tell you, Dave and I, Dave Whitten and I, have been trying talking to each other. We've tried Zoom, we've tried Jitsi, and we've tried Google Meet. And they all, at some level, are pretty equivalent. I think Zoom's probably got the advantage in big meetings.
And how about ease of use and ease for the new user? Is Zoom pretty easy that way compared to the others?
I think they're all about equivalent at this size of a meeting.
Yeah, I think so. I have a little experience. I have a lot of experience with Zoom. I have a little bit of experience with the Google Meet because my sister, who's a elementary music teacher, has had to use it for teaching some of her classes. And at least as of like 2 weeks ago, they were still missing some key features that Zoom had. For instance, she was not able to just mute everyone in her class all at once and then keep them muted, even though she was the host. I don't think that's a problem with our system here with these small meetings. But, you know, certainly when we're getting into, trying to host TAP or DCC, I think doing a Zoom webinar type of situation like we did for the HAMSCI workshop or they used for CTU is the way to go.
Yeah, and you think just a regular meeting is best for this kind of arrangement?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think it'd work out very well. And one of the one of the big things I think there's an advantage of, especially for this sort of technical meeting, is the ability to share screens. You know, when you're talking about schematics and you're talking about, like, all of these you're trying to describe these different things, just having the ability to share the screen is so powerful.
Yeah, I agree. And like, if we're talking about, you know, even block diagrams, I'm thinking, well, let me put up the clock block diagram for the DE. Oh, wait, I can't do it.
Yeah, it just works out. It works out so well. And I've been using it all semester to teach classes and interact with research students. And, like, I'll use it to show code. And even in certain circumstances, you know, when I've been coding with students, Zoom will actually let me request control of the other person's computer, and then I can make changes, you know, and show them code and stuff like that. And that doesn't make as much sense for this particular group, but certainly being able to share block diagrams, show what different papers look like, show schematics, pictures, use the pointing tools and the annotation tools. It's just really good.
I also remember you said you took your tablet and used something like Keep to draw on the tablet and share it over the Zoom.
Yeah, I have. It's like I have a notepad and I can basically use it as a virtual whiteboard where I'm just drawing right on my tablet, and that also works great.
So that would probably work with a PC and a touchscreen too, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Anyway, just something to think about. I wanted to throw it out there and let people think it over and see if they're interested. And, you know, if you don't have a camera, then you can still participate just with audio, and you can still share your screen even if you don't have a camera.
And it's also nice, too, because Zoom offers these telephone call-in numbers, too. So if you have a bad internet connection, you just dial in with your cell phone or your landline, and then use that audio connection instead of the internet connection. And so if your internet connection is spotty and your phone service is good, you still stay in the meeting the whole time, which works out really nicely.
I think we should go ahead and do it. I think I'll probably try to notify people. I mean, we can send a invite to the Tanger, you know, I don't know, either the normal people or at least tell people on the Tangerine list to ask for an invite. And then I need to put something here so that if somebody shows up and we're not here, they know where to go.
So, Dave, you could actually log in here and put the link down in the bottom, right?
Correct.
Then they could just click on it and they'd be connected.
I think we should do it because we've been using TeamSpeak because we started with TeamSpeak 12 years ago.
Yeah, I think Zoom would be much more effective. I've thought that for a while, but I didn't want to cramp anybody's style here.
Yeah, well, like Mike says, we're not normal.
This is the first time I realized why we were using TeamSpeak. I thought there was some reason, but now I know it was just legacy.
Yep, it's just legacy.
I asked myself that same question when I logged into TeamSpeak. Why are they using TeamSpeak and not Zoom?
Isn't TeamSpeak set up for like to be a system for a bunch of gamers?
Yeah, so people playing games together can talk while they're doing it or talk with one side, like if it's a competitive with two teams, one team can talk and the other team and say, go get that guy or whatever.
Wow, how 20th century.
You know, aren't there those systems that let you connect Morse code keys to your computer too? We could do that.
Hey, there are. There's the internet telegraph. We could all use those.
We could just all get on 20 meters, I suppose, if we thought we could all hear each other.
I could just see this. So we all decide that we're just going to call in on the Chicago repeater and have our QSO there. And nobody lives in Chicago.
Well, you know, there's all these different systems, you know, the D-Star and all these other things that allow people from anywhere to get all together in one thing. You know, why we could be using that, too.
I might get in trouble, though, because I'm funded on this project.
Anyway, it is well past time. I'm going to say 73 and talk to you guys next week. If you want me to ask Bill or Phil any questions about low band A to Ds, just send me an email because I talk to them once a week anyway.
Okay, very good. And I'm going to sign off here too. We were way over, but it was very interesting as usual. So 73s, everyone.